Dear listeners, welcome to Cider Voice. This episode is going to be a little bit special for you. I'm not going to be on it. Instead, you have a beautiful long conversation between our two champions of cider, Alip and Justin. My advice to you is, if you're listening to this on the move, in the car, on the train, just take a pause right now and come back this evening. Sit down with a full bottle of your favourite cider of the moment, pour yourself a glass, put the podcast on, close your eyes and listen. Be taken away, transported to the magical mind palaces of Adam and Justin as they go on a twirling, twisting exploration of their five seminal ciders that have affected their journey through cider and led them to this point talking to you today. Cheers.
You've achieved it.
No, Albert did it for us. I texted him and he wordlessly did it. So I don't know whether Albert's going to be here in the background.
Hello and welcome to Cider Voice, or as Albert likes to call it, Cider Voice. we don't need to worry about what Albert likes to call it because he's not with us today. Although, don't worry, he is very much still alive, and we will be releasing a photo imminently from the Cider Voice Twitter to prove it and put all doubts on the subject arrest.
And we definitely won't kill the story, and it definitely won't be photoshopped.
Yeah, there will be no issues with the photo whatsoever. It will be fine. Don't worry about Albert. He is very, very much in good health. But Justin is definitely in good health, and he's
Hello.
With us today. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thank you. I'm doing very well, in fact. It's my birthday's upcoming, so I'm very excited for that. And just kind of ticking over. How are you there, Adam? Nearly called you Albert. I'm so used to having you here.
I know. It does feel a little bit like the grown-ups have left and they're irresponsibly. The cellar is open, the car keys are on the shelf, and now
we're going to be
what we want.
Hey, topping up the water bottles with vodka, or the topping up the very, very rare and expensive 750 mils with, I don't know, what would you top? What would you? Here's a question, Adam. If you were to, in the manner of a badly behaved or slightly nefarious school child, sneaking into their parents' drink cupboard and drinking the vodka and topping it up with water to make it look like it hadn't moved, and you were to do that with, say, a raison d'etre, how would you top it up in a way that would make it look fine but wouldn't stand up to any inspection?
I don't know what the polite answer to that is. Albert's not editing this, is he?
No, I am. You'll be topping it up with more raison d'etre, because there will be only raison d'etre in this house.
Yeah, yeah. Look around Albert's house. Wait, what is there to top this up with? Wait, we can turn on the taps. That'll be, oh my god, how has he fixed the plumbing here?
How does he shower in raison d'etre? That must be awful. That'd get very sticky. Well, what a horrifying start to the podcast.
The other thing, Justin, is that we have unlimited license to go off topic today. You know, however much you want to talk about the harvesting of Neolithic wheat, there will be no window in this chat where a man is getting visibly more tense with every word.
Cider Voice, our first ever 5-hour episode. Yeah. That's unless I get really unhinged and start to come out with some really, really bad takes, and that's when you're going to be getting tense. You'll be like, oh no, Justin.
I'm really looking forward to the segment where we just make up opinions that Albert definitely has.
Oh yeah.
And say, you know, I can't believe. That'll be right before the I reckon section.
Yeah, I reckon. Here's how if I was every cider maker, I would simply do this. I don't understand all this guff about 7,000 litres and tax. If I was a small, independent craft cider maker working in the UK these days, I would simply stop complaining and sell my stuff. Like, how hard can it be?
Why don't they simply make 1 million litres of amazing full juice cider and then sell all those litres?
Exactly, precisely. And the thing is, you'd be perfectly capable of selling it at the same rate in a pub and having it be accepted. simply market your drink.
Just as accepted by the drinkers at the pub who want to consume it from a pint, it will be equally as accepted in 750 mils for a mere, you know, 30 to 35 pounds a bottle. And both drinkers would be absolutely fine with the way that we portray. I reckon there's just a lot of fuss over nothing.
I think so. And if ever you and I were to try our hand at cider making, I am sure we would instantly not only become a gigantic commercial success overnight, but also remain absolutely pure to our vision and ethically unimpeachable in doing so.
No, I reckon we'd compromise.
I reckon we'd compromise out of principle. I reckon we'd be like, well, we don't really want to back out on our principles, but, well, our principles are that we're pathetic, horrible, cowardly men. And so we must compromise, even though there's actually no incentive to do so.
Instantly, you know, we get to, like, apple number one, and I'm like, oh, Justin, I can't crush it properly.
you just drop a single apple and go, right, Justin, I've dropped it, it's ruined, we're using concentrate.
Directly to concentrate.
Immediately.
Do not pass go.
Do not collect 200 awards. Or maybe do collect 200 awards. I don't know.
The other thing I reckon is that I reckon loads and loads of our 12 listeners to whom we are now giving the customary shout out have been really wanting an episode that's just us. But we wouldn't know that because Albert is the recipient of all the emails to Cider Voice. And I reckon that if people had been emailing saying, when's the Justin and Adam only episode coming up, he wouldn't have sent it on to us. And since he hasn't sent anything on to us, I reckon there have been loads of emails to that point. So
what we're really saying is that Albert Johnson of the Ross and Y Cider and Perry Company is in fact a malign influence upon the world of cider, squatting toad-like. And with his long, sticky, bittersweet tongue lashing out and preventing his co-hosts from reaching their true, magnificent final selves.
I'll be really, really pleased with this episode. Another one really soon. Actually, talking of Albert's malevolent influence over the world of cider, he is now the chairman of the Three Counties Cider and Perry Association, which is great. And on that note, I should remember, because we will win back some points for this, that we should be plugging CraftCon, coming up in a few weeks' time. That's April the 5th and 6th, and it's the UK's number one craft cider X. I don't know. It's been a long day. not exhibition. It's a conference. That's the word I was looking for. It's literally in the name, CraftCon.
Should we re-record that, or are we going to let that stand?
No filler today, Justin.
I like the way that when we were just sort of being unhinged and doing a long and frankly, it's slightly cruel bit about Albert, that it was just flowing off the tongue. And as soon as we've tried to be serious, we're immediately stuttering and forgetting what we're meant to be saying.
No, but we're very unpracticed at that. But anyway, yeah, so people should absolutely book their tickets for CraftCon. I've got a serious podcast voice on at the moment. And so I'm saying seriously that it's not just for makers, although it is very much for makers. Obviously, you and I aren't makers, and we're very much looking forward to it. So whether you're an advocate, a drinker, just somebody who loves cider, or whether you are either making or intending to make cider, you should absolutely come along because there's nothing else like it in the UK calendar.
I think as well, even if you aren't particularly interested in making it yourself, even if you're just a person who is interested in how things, like, you know, how things are made, interested in food and drink, all that kind of thing, I'd recommend it because it's always, as people might already know, concerning my own tastes, I find people making anything is fascinating to me. I spend many, many hours on YouTube binges watching people, you know, the kind of thing where it's like, I'm going to make paper from scratch. And I'm like, I'm never going to make paper from scratch, but this is cool as hell. That's a very weird example, but I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to stick.
Yeah, maybe there is a paper con somewhere that you'll be able to go along to.
Almost certainly, but I imagine that it's much more corporate, and I also imagine that there's much less talk about like the craft of paper and much more talk about things like, it turns out that the computer chips we're using in our paper manufacturing plants have gone up by 2% this year. This is devastating financial news, and the paper industry is about to collapse.
You say that, but what if there's like a real or aspirational paper movement? They're railing against big paper who only use like 35%
paper.
Yeah. That's the A5. That's the A5 scum.
Yeah, they only use 35% paper. The rest is concentrated apple juice and sugar.
Which is incredibly messy, gums up printers.
Yeah. It's why when you put your pen on cheap paper, it just bleeds into it. Incidentally, related to, we're definitely going to get onto our topic of the episode now. We need to just get all this nervous energy out to begin with. I was talking to a friend of mine that makes science infographics and like science. She's like a science educator. It's
Albert
really sick.
Is raging right now.
Blood pouring from his eyes. She's like a science filmmaker. She makes films to like educate people about science. So if you've ever clicked on one of those videos that's like, do you know how cells work, that like pop up on Facebook and stuff, she makes those. And we had a really interesting conversation where she told me about the world's like, the world is running out of sand, which was like bizarrely horrifying, that it turns out that there is a particular type of sand. I think it's like river sand or something like that, or gravel. It was either sand or gravel. I think it's sand. And basically, in order to produce certain things like concrete, certain industrial products, you require this very particular type of sand. You can't just use any old sand. You can't just go into the desert or onto a beach and just scoop up sand from manufacturing. It has to be this very particular type of sand due to the particular sharpness of each granule. And the world is literally running out of it, because it's not getting produced quickly, because sand is slow to be produced. And I found that, like, in a world that is slowly sort of collapsing, and we see all this kind of horrifying climate stuff and, you know, resource scarcity emerging, the idea of we are running out of sand, of something that is, like, proverbially massive in quantity, I found that absolutely mortally terrifying.
That is, yeah, that's like, incredibly sinister. That's like the kind of neutral's joy opposite of Leicester winning the Premier League, where you sort of think one thing is going to happen and you're focused on that. And then out of nowhere, you know, sand against all the odds, against all the bookmakers, like creeps up and is what destroys us all.
Yeah, you're like, oh, we thought it was going to be the rising sea levels, but no, we literally ran out of sand. Anyway, moving. Shall we move on to what we're drinking and then talk about the actual episode?
Yeah, I'm. Before we move on to what we're drinking, because that like feels like something that
I have a mere 4-hour bit.
No, I have a mere 10,000 word aside. No, I was going to actually introduce the episode, and then we'll come back to what we're drinking, because you know, at this point we have recorded for about 20 minutes. Albert's probably, you know, his brain is melting somewhere. He's got audio scurvy as a result of all our stupid asides. And
he hasn't had enough vitamin C. And what I mean by that is vitamin content.
I hate myself. No, it's okay. We're moving on from that. We're introducing the episode. We're ready to go. And the episode today is... It's kind of, I guess it's the first in what I hope will be a series, all with half-hour tangential introductions. But it's kind of, I suppose it's a Desert Island Discs, but it's cider. And this kind of comes back to something that I think about on Cider Review, which is that, you know, Cider Review is built on long form content, and that's great, and I really love reading the articles that people come up with. I love writing articles myself, but the proof of concept, and the concept is that cider is
really, really great. It's good. I like to drink it. This is a drink of craft and care whose best examples stand up with absolutely, you know, any drink you can mention, and which are capable of these of giving us these moments of real meaning as well as pleasure. And so what I thought it would be cool to do would be to speak to people about five, in inverted commas, seminal ciders, ciders that have been really important to them on their journey. And they'd also stand up with, you know, iconic wines or beers that or spirits that people in other sectors might talk about. Because it's really common to read wine writers or beer writers, commentators, whatever, talking about, you know, such and such brewery made this, you know, incredible beer that made them change the way they thought about the category, and that is an icon and, you know, something that other breweries massively look up to and seek to emulate. Ditto wines, you know, people might always have that kind of classic sideways question of, you know, what was the bottle that did it and all this sort of thing. And I'd love that to be more the case for cider. And I think it is. I think there are certainly ciders and perries, that have affected me personally and have influenced the course of my journey, or left a real tangible mark on me. And I think that's true of you as well. Or if it isn't, this is going to be a really short episode.
What ciders have meant anything to you, Justin? Nothing. I have no emotional connection to this.
Back to sand.
Back to sand. Back to Winnipeg.
But so that's the idea of this episode. It's you know, our proof of concept, I suppose, that you know, the reason that we are here making these episodes and talking to so many people and getting excited about this drink is that, you know, it can be something really, really extraordinary. And we're going to give some specific examples of the extraordinary ciders that, you know, have really impacted us on our journey. So that is what this episode is going to be. But before we crack on with your first seminal cider, what are you drinking?
So I'm not actually drinking a cider. My ciders remain with another friend because we decided that they would drive back with them after the Ross on Rye Cider Festival. And then we haven't actually worked out a way to get them from their house to mine.
Forever. Like, yeah. These are the Cider Voice staples, the 12 listeners and the mystery friend.
The mystery case. And the only two ciders I currently have in the house are both bottles that I'm saving. So I am having a Waterford. I'm having the Micro Cuvée Pique-Nique, which is, it's Waterford, so it's great. So it's for those who don't know about Waterford, they're a whiskey maker, distillery. They also have a rum distillery in Grenada, Renegade. And this is banging. I think...
Before you extol its virtues further, we should admit that I work for this company. You know, traditionally, we have to shill for somebody who is connected to Cider Voice.
Yeah, I was going to say. So instead of shilling for Ross on Rye, I'm going to shill for Waterford. What's about to happen is I'm about to go off on an absolutely vicious rant about how much I hate it, but you will hear an AI reconstructed version of my voice talking about how great it is, and you'll merely need to understand all my criticisms by implication. No, I think it's great. I really like, I mean, you know, it's anyone who's ever heard me talk about spirits will know that I have, you know, I have a lot of time for Waterford. I really enjoy them. I think it's very much the case that I don't like it because Adam works there. Adam works there because he likes it. And I think it's, to be mildly controversial, this is not my favorite of the Waterfords, not because it's bad, but just because there are others that I like even more. Some of the single farm ones I find really intellectually interesting and engaging and very characterful. But this is great. It's got that lovely sort of almost brioche-y, bready like aspect that I feel like some Waterfords have, or all Waterfords have, that kind of house style where it really does taste of the grain. You really can taste the ingredient absolutely barreling through, and being bottled at 50 gives it that, you know, you're not breaking up any of those oils in the spirit to get really sort of Dorky and Anoraki and Technical. You're not breaking up any of those oils in the spirit, so it's still got bags of character, bags of expression, and the weight of the spirit is such that you know, there are some spirits you can have at 50 and you feel like your head's about to burn off. Whereas this one, I mean, you can stick this next to a 42% spirit and you'd need to concentrate to know that the ABV was as high as it is. It holds its weight so well. But yeah, I'm very, very happy with that. Very happy having that. What about yourself? What are you drinking?
We'll come back to that in a second. The three things from what you have just said. Firstly, thank you very much for giving Waterford a shout out.
Absolutely.
Secondly, Albert's going to be absolutely raging that, you know, just when he thought we were going to get back on track and talking about cider, what are you drinking? let me talk about some terroir-derived whiskey.
Yeah, imagine doing a podcast where we talk about things. I mean, just appalling.
But the third thing I was going to ask was it an intended pun when you said that flavors come barreling through? Or...
No, actually, I said it, and then I was close to referencing the fact that I just accidentally made a pun, and then I decided that there had been too many digressions. You skipped your second point. What was your first? You said 3 points. Then you said about.
Yeah, no, the first point was thank you. The second point was Albert's going to be raging. And the third point was, is this a pun? So anyway, what I'm drinking, interestingly, is also spirit related. But Albert will be thrilled to know that it is a bit linked to cider. I am drinking a Mistel from Killahora Orchards. So for those of our listeners who don't know what a Mistel is, Mistel is a bringing together of about two-thirds of a fruit juice with one-third of that fruit spirit. In this case, obviously, apple. And the most famous apple Mistels are the Pommeaux of Normandy and Brittany. But this is not from Normandy or Brittany. It's, in fact, from Ireland. So we are a very Ireland-heavy tasting episode today. This is from Killahora Orchards, who are actually pretty close to Waterford. They're just along the south coast, east of Cork. I very much like their name. It's called Pom apostrophe O.
It's a nice bottle. I really like that label design.
It's really lovely. They make fantastic stuff there, and they have a beautiful orchard which has got one of the most one of the largest collections of apple and pear varieties I've ever come across. Really, really stunning orchard looking out towards the ocean. But this one I think is quite clever because it has looked at what they do in Normandy with their pomo, and they've gone, how can we put our own twist on it? So it's not just that they're using Irish fruit. Rather than aging their pomo in Calvados barrels, they have used some Irish whiskey barrels. This one doesn't say from which distillery, but we just know that they're ex-Irish whiskey barrels. And I believe they also put in some local herbs and flowers and things. Just a subtle. I think if you didn't know that, you wouldn't go absolutely what else has been in this. But when you do know that, there's a little bit of a kind of herbal twist, and so it's a sort of lighter and fresher style of pomo, and it's really, really tasty. Really, really tasty. This is the 2020 vintage. I've previously had no. Sorry, I'm telling a complete lie. No, I'm not telling a complete lie. It is the 2020 vintage.
Yourself.
Solid, yes. Some solid continuity there. Anyway, but I've had a previous vintage.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Adam. Some solid vitamin C. I'm going to make this horrible bit happen if it kills me.
Well, you can, for Albert is not neither here nor editing. It all goes in. It all adds up to...
Every time I say vitamin C, it'll be bass boosted and given loads of reverb.
It all adds up to the 3-hour vitamin C tablet that will be this episode. But anyway, lovely, lovely stuff from Killahora Orchards.
Where can you get it?
Well, I got this actually direct from source when I was lucky enough to visit them in October or November of the year before last. Cider is Wine, I believe, sell this and possibly the Cat in the Glass, or they certainly did at some point when they have some in at the moment. I have no idea. But it's certainly been on sale in the UK previously. And if it's not, then I highly recommend making the trip to Ireland, and you could even drop in at a terroir-driven whiskey distillery on your way past.
Heaven forfend.
Now we have done the what are you drinking and the plug for CraftCon and, you know, clawed back a few points from Albert as a result. Let's get on to the meat of the episode. So, Justin, would you like to tell us about your first seminal cider, maybe contextualizing it with, you know, where you drank it, why it was seminal, all this sort of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a I've got five here in total. My understanding of the brief, as said, was although I would back all of these, and I would say that everybody, you know, if you can get your hands on them, or if it's no longer in production, get on something from the maker or something like that, I would back all of these. These are not necessarily my very favorite drinks ever or the best things I've ever tried. But what they are is drinks that are very important to me and important to my journey into cider. So we've talked about my journey into cider before several times on the episodes, on the pod, so I don't need to sort of go into that in great detail. But that does directly sort of map onto what I'm about to talk about. The first one on the list is one I think we've mentioned the occurrence of this happening, but we haven't mentioned, I don't know if I've mentioned this particular drink. So way back when, 6 years ago, was it, that we went on that tour? 2019?
Yeah, five, I reckon.
Five. So I got into, as mentioned, the very quick Cliff Notes version is I got into cider and perry shortly after Adam did, because Adam wanted somebody to go and visit some orchards with. I said yes, and then tried some cider and perry and decided that this was a thing that was interesting and could also get lots of cider and perry from Adam. And the bottle that really turned me from this is an interesting drink to oh, this is something that I really want to try more of was a bottle of Butford Organics Perry. I cannot unfortunately remember exactly what it was. I think Adam has this noted down. Do you remember what it was that we tried?
Yeah, it would have been Aurora.
Aurora.
Which was okay. Their, which is not their single variety, it's their blend. I don't know what it would have been a blend of or which vintage it would have been. I would have guessed 2018, but I don't have that detailed a record, but it was certainly Aurora.
So, in that case, what it was is a Butford Organics Aurora, drunk in 2019, probably 2018 vintage. This was the first time I've ever had a perry that wasn't Lambrini or Baby Sham. Prior to drinking Lambrini and Baby Sham, I didn't even know that they were perries. I thought they were, some kind of sweet wine. I knew that perry existed. Beyond that, not a clue. And I, having never knowingly had a perry before, this was a real game changer because it was more accessible than the ciders I'd been trying. More on that in a moment. But you know, we've waxed rhapsodic on this show about how much we love perry. You know, Adam's written a bloody book on it. And just trying this and having like those kind of bright, fresh fruit flavors, the kind of green hedgerowiness of it. I always feel like perry, if cider tastes like, cider tastes of like, you know, obviously of apples. But to me, I always, to weave a romantic and bucolic image in my head of what it makes me feel like, to be horribly bourgeois about it. Cider often makes me think of a more general kind of like patchwork farm landscape. Perry tastes of trees and hedgerows. Like perry is so intensely, for me, like green plants. Whatever it is, whether it's those in autumn or those in spring, it has that aspect. And I distinctly remember trying the Aurora that it conjured up those images of this taste of trees, but also this new interesting drink that I hadn't tried before. That I had a cup of and immediately was like, man, I could go for another one of those. That is amazing. I could happily just sit and drink that. My relationship with cider at that point was, as I said, quite intellectual, quite sort of like, this is something interesting. don't really know whether I like it or not, but I'm interested in it. And this Butford Organic Perry was the first one that I went, oh no, this is something that I would happily drink, and I can pull it apart intellectually, or I can turn that side of my brain off and have tasty thing. So that's number one, which is Butford Organics Aurora, probably 2018.
That's awesome. I remember that trip so fondly. I mean, I was heavily, actually, I mean, it isn't in one of my five for this episode, but I think I've written before that, you know, when I first got into cider, I had, you know, my intention had been to just keep Perry as an absolutely separate thing. So I recognized it was a different drink, and I was like, you know what? Nope, I'm going to laser focus on cider. Perry is a different drink. I will not be distracted by that. I'm going after cider, but inevitably you can't visit Herefordshire producers without being given Perry's. And I think I, you know, whilst I can't remember what the first Perry I had that I liked was, the one where I went, oh yeah, okay, I'm being willfully stupid here. I cannot ignore this other drink. It is too fascinating and too brilliant. Was probably that Aurora Butford's. You know, I remember. I think that was the first time that I just felt steeped in Three Counties Perry and realizing just how deeply it went, how important it was, and also in its own right, how fascinating and brilliant a drink Perry was. You know, and the rest is sort of current affairs.
That's awesome. And yeah, like you, I've sort of been kind of giving some thought to, you know, what my five seminal ciders and Perry's would be, and I've come to the same conclusion of, you know, whilst these are five absolutely phenomenal ciders and Perry's, you know, if I just tried to go, what my five best ever, I just don't think I could do it because, you know, I think there's so many incredible producers, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens, your Antoine Marois, your Yves South Hill, you know, so many incredible producers that wouldn't necessarily be in the like five most important ciders ever. It's so much harder to.
Well, it's also that they scratch different itches, don't they? Like it's something I find so annoying about, like, here are the best five ever, and it's like, well, every time you do a best five list, you've got to pick from such a broad and bizarre range of criteria. The part of the issue with, like, top five lists or best things ever is that they all, you know, you don't want them to be fighting with each other, and it's hard to pick because they all scratch different itches. Like, that you can have, you know, if I make a top five list of the best five ever, the criteria are going to be so broad and have to be so a weird mixture of broad and specific that you're not, I don't know, I don't have all that much time for, like, top five ever. Like, where you look at, like, film lists, where it's like, here are the best five films ever. And it's like, it's stupid to pick five, because you can't compare them. Like, you know, you can have a credible argument for being like, oh, well, Star Wars Episode IV is one of the top five films ever. And so is Come and See, the 1980 What's It film about the goddamn Eastern Front, that's one of the most traumatic things anyone will ever see. Fundamentally and utterly different films, like completely wildly different. And even then, they're closer than some other films that you could pick are. And the fact of them inhabiting the same place on some kind of top five abstractly best list, where they are so fundamentally different in what they're trying to do and aiming to do, it's bizarre. It doesn't work. So, I mean, like, if it's... Anyway... Rant on fives ever.
This is the episode for rants.
Yeah, I guess, like, with this, like, going for, like, a five that are very important rather than I'm going to abstractly pick five that I think are simply and just the best ever.
I'd like to report that we have just had a message from Albert saying, how long is this episode, lol? Wait till he finds out that we're doing 10 ciders and we're so far one in.
Still, that didn't take long. Right, so let's, without further ado, let's move on to...
Seminal ciders. I mean, if I was being, you know, completely... what are the ciders that have most influenced me? Then I would definitely have to have Strongbow on that list, because I think I've mentioned
on the podcast, and I've certainly written about it, that you know, my first experience of cider was my friend ordering a Strongbow when I was like 16 or so at a party. Me not really knowing what that was. I'd seen some of the adverts, thought it was a beer. I knew I didn't like beer, but I didn't want to, you know, awkwardly stand in the corner with a Diet Coke. So feeling social pressure at this precocious age, I said, yeah, I'll just have one of those. And then lo and behold, it didn't taste like, you know, weird sort of grainy bad stuff. It tasted like sort of sweetish, fruity, apple-y, not great stuff. And I thought, yeah, I can manage this. And you know, and so cider became my pint from there. But I don't really want to, for all of my connection to Strongbow, I don't really want to extol its virtues, because its virtues are entirely self-imposed there. And we are about celebrating aspirational cider. So the bottle that mainly dragged me into aspirational cider was the 2014 vintage from a cidery called Chalkdown, which I encountered when I was working in the wine industry. And I had previously certainly tried some, you know, farmhouse or craft ciders. And whilst I hadn't hated them, they hadn't lingered long enough for me to, you know, take the names down, dive any further out of my own way, you know, go and look for other stuff. But I remember, you know, sitting in a like buyer's meeting at work, when the buyers would kind of present stuff that they wanted to add to the range to us. And one of our buyers, who also covered cider and beer, said, you know, I've got this cider that's made the same way as champagne. And that to me was absolutely wild. And you know, we could talk for a long while about the marketing power of the word champagne. And our friend Rachel Hendry has certainly written brilliantly on this in the subject of both wine and beer, as well as cider and perry. And I know that Albert would have takes on us discussing champagne at any great length on the podcast. But the point is that as somebody who was, you know, very well versed in wine, you know, I'd done all my WSET stuff, worked in the industry for a long time, and saw myself working in it indefinitely. You know, that makes you sit up. You know, if he could have said any other wine and it wouldn't have had the same power. But, you know, here's a cider that's made the same way as champagne. I thought, wow, that's very cool. I had to learn about that. You know, we tasted it, and it's a gorgeous cider. I mean, Peter at Chalkdown, you know, makes some of the best traditional method ciders in the country for sure. And the 2014 vintage was a real cracker. You know, good amount of time on the lees. It had a good bit of age in bottle. You know, and the apples that he uses are I would put it in the category of ciders that are trying to be a reasonable facsimile of the specific flavor profile of champagne, you know, trying to get that green apple and citrus flavor overlaid with the kind of biscuity brioche-iness of lees, and he does that very effectively. And yeah, so I tried this cider. I thought, it's incredible. Wow, a cider made like champagne. I clearly need to look more into you know, into this world of ciders that aren't just what I'm drinking on tap at the pub, and aren't just you know, a bag in box or something that I might see in the pub. You know, I need to learn a little bit more, and so that was my first step, which must have been 2016 or so, into just going and learning about aspirational ciders, and it led to reading Pete Brown and Bill Bradshaw's wonderful book, World's Best Cider. And then visiting these amazing producers like Albert, Little Pomona, ultimately Tom Oliver, and others. So, you know, even though I had been drinking cider as my pint in the pub for some time before then, you know, Chalkdown is really kind of the point that I would say was what brought me into, you know, this world where I'm spending my Monday evenings doing a podcast about cider for no money.
What are you talking about? We've got all those that massive amount of sponsorship money we have. You're not meant to say this. You know, this is why we're shilling for Waterford and Ross on Wires, because we're all getting massive amounts of money from them.
Yeah, as it happens, our 12 listeners are all oligarchs, and we feel morally conflicted about that. But you know, which we'll edit out. But that's not to say
we'll just edit out our moral.
Yeah, if you've got scruples, just edit them out. That's my motto. So yeah, that would be my first seminal cider. How about you? Where do you move on to from there?
Well, I'm actually moving on to the exact same trip. I thought I would do two as complements to one another, because my next one is the Little Pomona Brut Cremant, which was so this was shortly after they started making.
In fact, it was right before it hadn't been released when we tried
Blimey. And this is an interesting one, because I've talked a lot about, you know, when I first had dry cider, I didn't know what it was and was a little bit startled by it. And this is when I say that, what I mean is I was specifically startled by the Little Pomona Brut Cremant, because I had it and it was tannic and 100% dry and extremely elegant and very fresh. And I didn't know what the hell this was, because I'd never had anything like it. And I remember I didn't dislike it. I remember actually refilling my glass a couple of times just to try to get a handle on what it was, because it was so far outside my comfort zone. And I came away, and I remember coming away, and this was the one where I was like, well, that was really interesting. I'm intrigued by that. But I wouldn't necessarily sit down and go, hell yeah, I'll have another glass of that. And then as my sort of journey into cider has continued, the more I've had, the more I've been able to put words to the flavors I'm having, articulate them, recognize them. It feels also like I can simply taste more. Like, what's bizarre is now I have a glass of a fully dry tannic cider, and I feel like I can actually taste more than I used to. It's extraordinary. Sort of my palate has really advanced in that way. And yeah, just as a kind of mark from how far I've come, where at the time you were like, Justin, this is incredible. And I was like, I almost don't quite see it. I can. I'll take your word for it, but I don't quite see it. And then now I'm like, man, I wish I could go back and try the Brut Cremant, because I had the Brut Zero a couple of months ago, and it was absolutely banging, absolutely banging.
Yeah, I will say, as great as the Brut Cremant was, I do think the Brut Zero represented another like step change up.
Right.
I haven't had the Brut Cremant for a long, long time. I couldn't like rattle off the flavor profile off the top of my head, but I don't think it made quite the same impact on me as Brut Zero did, although it was a phenomenal cider.
I think that's it, is that this, I mean, this is coming back to it, that, you know, Brut Zero might well be a whole new level, but the Brut Cremant's the one that I had, and the Brut Cremant's the one that I went, I don't know how I feel about this. Not in a general, like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this, i.e. implication bad. I don't know how I feel about this in a, this is fascinating and completely alien, and I want to learn more. So whereas the Butford Organics Aurora is the one that went, yeah, this is something I could like. This is one that went, this is some, okay, you've got my attention now. This is singular.
Would you say that the Butford or Organics was an exclamation mark and the Little Pomona was a question mark?
Well, I wouldn't have said it in quite so, let's call that a literary manner, rather than something more pejorative.
That was stolen from leading wine writer Hugh Johnson there.
Annoying. That's one of those ones where it's like, that's a bit like, yeah, oh, come on, but that is actually really good. You know, one of those things where it's almost annoying.
Brilliant line. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's such a good line.
Shut up. Why didn't I think that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a completely correct. The Butford Organics was an exclamation mark of a wow, delicious, great, expressive, also alien. And then the Brut Cremant was a, but seriously, what is this? This is interesting. And that, I think that was, I mean, you know, if only everybody could have the experience that I did of my entrance to cider being sitting in a room with the two people who have just made this extraordinary drink and them discussing it. Like, what a privilege.
I think it's a really good point, though. I mean, you know, tannins, and this is something that I'm talking about hopefully at CraftCon, you know, they're unfamiliar and they are bitter. There is a reason these apples are called bitter sweets and bitter sharps, you know. And I certainly, you know, when I had started going down this rabbit hole, would find drinks, some of which were Albert's, that I would just be like, what is this flavor? This feels too much. I cannot wrap my head around this. I'm not used to this. And then I realized, I mean, you know, I've written before about my first ever experience of drinking Albert's Raison d'Etre was you know, I was still on that automatic pilot that I guess most people who are new to cider are on, of being like, oh, it's a cider, I'll stick it in the fridge. And so all the tannins became more closed up, they became colder and more astringent. You know, the apple fruitiness, you know, dialed back, and the tannins and oak and everything else were really, really to the fore. And I was like, everyone's saying this is amazing, so it must be, I must be the one who is wrong here. But, you know, this is quite a bit. And it was only, you know, conversations with people like Tom and Albert saying, well, you know, would you put a really tannic wine in the fridge? And I'd be like, no, I wouldn't actually. Realizing you know, there isn't just one way to approach a cider, and that you know, there are, you don't want to say, oh, yeah, no, let me tell you how you need to taste this cider. But equally, there are, chemical and biological reasons for serving certain things at certain temperatures and for allowing them to express themselves. And I just hadn't learned that at that point. And actually learning that and learning how to come at a cider on its terms, not on my terms, I suppose, a little bit more, was really instructional. And I've certainly got a lot more out of cider and perry as a result. But I completely agree. And I think a lot of people can relate to the journey that you went on with, you know, with tannins and with the relative youth of the cider, and with realizing, you know, this is a living, developing,
yeah,
physical, structural thing. It's not just here is a flavor, it's here is a really distinct structure. And that's something that takes some getting used to with cider, I think, or at least some mental adjustment to.
And I think the idea of getting used to something is a bit of a vexed topic. I mean, to bring it back to film, as I did earlier, you know, no spoilers here, I'm a film geek. It's one of the things I sometimes find a bit depressing about the capital D, the discourse, surrounding films online, especially, where the idea that something can be difficult, and maybe you don't like it at first, but it might grow on you, is sometimes presented as being unacceptable. You know, how dare something not instantly yield up its joys to you? It should be self-evident. You shouldn't need to get to know anything. You shouldn't need to develop a taste for something. And then that sort of also ramifies out into the weird, like, and therefore, anybody who dares critique anything mainstream is scum. Maybe we'll edit that bit out. But and then that sort of ramifies out into this sense that the only things that anyone is really allowed to like are actually just the kind of big tentpole releases. Now, there's nothing wrong with them. I'm perfectly happy watching a big kind of, you know, fun blockbustery film. Why not?
It's fun. I twitched ever so slightly when you said that.
You know, blood pouring from my nose. They're great fun. They're designed to serve a purpose, but there's enough room for things that are sort of instantly gratifying and fun and great and wonderful in that regard, and also things where you can go that require a little bit of perhaps effort to familiarize yourself with their cadences, with the song sheet that they're singing from. Like, I mean, I'm now a, I love, here we go, we're really getting into digression territory here. I love mid-20th century Japanese film. And the first time I watched an Ozu film, I was like, fuck me, this is dull as shit. What's going on? Didn't even make my way through it, and then about a year later came back and couldn't tear myself away from the screen. You know, now he's one of my very favorite directors. I think he's incredible, wonderful, but it took some getting used to, and some things do. And I think it's one of the difficulties with Bittersweet Cider in particular, that the tannic profile is so different to so many other drinks. I mean, you've got a bit of a routine if you've got a friend who's like a big red wine drinker. But for everybody else, if people are mainly drinking beer or sweetened cider, And I say sweetened, not just sweet cider, but sweetened cider, because it's a different flavor profile. You know, it can be a little bit difficult to onboard people by saying, hi, this is going to be completely alien to what you're used to, and you might not like it at first, but you'll come around to it, because it's like, well, that's not liking, that's Stockholm syndrome. But anyway, I've had this rant on the podcast before, I think, so who knows, maybe we'll edit this out.
I think it's...
Do you get me? Do you feel me?
I do, I completely get you. And actually, that's quite a neat note with which to segue into my second Seminole cider. Which is going to be my third, but it makes more sense to follow on from what you've just said. And it's another little Pomona, actually. So they're getting the double shout out. And they've made so many ciders that I've loved in the past. But this one I loved particularly for a range of reasons. But it starts with an apple. And we've talked about how tannins can be difficult for some people to approach. But this apple is difficult and notorious for being very, very, very high acid. And that's Foxwelp. And, you know, different people have really, really positive initial responses to different things. And for whatever reason, you know, I can't remember, which is wild because it's the sort of thing that you ought to remember. But I can't remember the first time I had Foxwelp, but I have never had anything but an entirely positive reaction to this apple. You know, I've always absolutely loved it. Every one that I can remember, you know, it's just been the absolute one. You know, my article on apple varieties, which was one of the very first things that I wrote about cider, which we've talked about before. You know, we tried 9 different varieties. And my top two were Yarlington Mill and Foxwelp. And so I've consistently loved this apple and consistently been frustrated that for a long time, a little bit less so these days, but certainly when I started writing and when I started really getting into Foxwelp, but specifically getting into cider, you know, people were pretty openly derogatory towards Foxwelp. You know, they would say, oh, no, it's completely unbalanced. You know, it cannot be a single variety. You know, it's just acid and nothing else. It doesn't have a flavor profile. I do remember somebody, Andy, who made cider for Sanford Orchards, a really great guy who wrote a blog before I did, which I very much miss. But he put out a tweet saying single variety Foxhop is for perverts.
To jump in on that, like the idea of balance as being necessarily like the thing in and of itself, like what's wrong with something being singular? Oh, is that what you're about to say?
Yeah, I was about to say that. But that's all right. No, you put it perfectly. I refuse to let you edit it out. No, this is real life, Justin. That's going into exactly what I was going to say.
Listeners, you can't see our videos, but Adam was pulling the most hilarious like emoji frown face you've ever seen as I was saying balance. You know. Anyway, Adam, I'll let you finish your point without stealing it from you.
Yeah, well, I think two things. Firstly, you're right. You know, and I obviously at the time I was coming from a world where, you know, I'll lap up you know, straight from cask strength heavily peated whiskey. You know, I am very, very happy with intensities, and I think that, you know, intensity has its place just as much as like whatever people's concept of balance, which I think is a subject for a long discussion, because I think people just say balance without having really considered what balance means to either them or to others. But that's an aside. So firstly, I was like, no, Foxhop makes a statement. Some people might hate it, and that's fine. I love it. You know, some people hate peaty whiskey. It's a big, intense flavor. I love it. You know, it's fine. But A, that, and B, I always felt that people just talked about acid. They only ever talked about the acid of Foxwelp. And so, you know, to me, Foxwelp has just this most pristine and distinct and beautiful aroma and flavor. And people get so hung up on the acid. And, you know, most of the time you taste a Foxwelp, you probably never had acid like it. And that is what you're thinking about. It's like what you were saying. You know, if you sort of take the acid into account, you know, and you focus on everything else, there's this astonishing red-fruited aromatic profile that also comes through on the palate. And so it was an apple that I loved. And Little Pomona are also fans of the Apple. In fact, I remember James telling me of his experience of people's Fox Whopper version being when he was judging at the Bath, the very famous Bath and West cider competition, and another cider maker picked up a blind sample, smelt it, went Fox Whelp, and just poured it out, didn't even taste it. There's absolute no. And James was like, no, what are you talking about? It's got this beautiful profile, this aroma, this flavor, this strength of character. And it's one of the four apples that grows in his orchard. So he's always been interested in that. And he's done a lot of wonderful things with it. But in 2017, Fox Whelp and another apple, Ellis Bitter, they were the cornerstones of a trio of Art of Darkness ciders that were released.
Mm-hmm.
And Art of Darkness is their annual exploration into long cask aging. Always based around those two apples, partially, because they have these big, big structures, and aging softens things like acid and tannin, and so that was his kind of investigation into what would happen there. And for the 2017 vintage, he got his hands on these gorgeous barrels that previously held Ornellaia, which is a very highly rated and coveted red wine from Italy. And they were French oak barrels from a really fantastic cooperage called Seguin Moreau, the highest quality of oak. And they'd held this beautiful red wine. And so he put Ellis Bitter and Fox Whelp into them in varying different proportions. And ultimately released them nearly 2 years later as this trio. And all of them were wonderful. I loved every single one. But part two was 75% Ellis Bitter, 25% Fox Whelp. Part three was 50-50. And part one, which is the cider that I'm kind of using as my second seminal cider, was 75% Fox Whelp and 25% Ellis Bitter. And to me, it was just, for a long, long, long time, like almost that apogee of Fox Whelp. And, I know Albert will be complaining, well, it wasn't a single variety Fox Whelp, about 25% of something else. But I mean, it was all about Fox Whelp. It was taking that gorgeous profile that I'd come to know and love so well and using oak, really complementary oak. And I think red wine casks are perfect for Fox Whelp to just elevate it into its most beautiful and eloquent expression, where it's just a celebration of those gorgeous red fruits, and almost this like maturity, this kind of going into like almost Pinot Noirish truffliness. And yeah, there was still that acidity, but I loved it. It was great. It was phenomenal. And I still think of that as my favorite dry still cider of all time. I bought so many bottles of that. I think I bought, I bought you the trio. I bought another friend the trio. I was just like, I don't need people to try this. This is so good. So, so good. And the only Fox Whelp really that has come close to it since, well, are two more from those same barrels that Little Pomona have put out. Their Brut Zero that we talked about before, which was a core of that Fox Whelp. Solera, some of the parts that they've got coming out soon. And then also Albert C1 2022, which is not still, but that is a single variety Fox Whelp, and that again is just like a celebration of what Fox Whelp is all
Adam,
about.
That's three bottles, not
no, well, I'm just putting the part one up as the one that really gripped me. It was just something else. I still think of that as just cider that took my idea of how good still dry cider could be and ratcheted up several notches.
Speaking of still dry cider, in fact, so I was very close to including a Fox Whelp on this list, but what I realized is, although much like you, there must be something in the Wells palate that's just attracted to acid. But much like you, I adore Fox Whelp. It's one of my very favorite apples. If I ever see it, I'm like, yeah, I'll have one of those first. And adore it. But I realized that me getting into Fox Whelp happened after I was already bought in, and there haven't been any that have been of that, this kind of seminal position. And one that is, however, is, oh God, this is where I really embarrass myself, what I believe to be a still dry cider, which is Yves Albee Hill.
Oh yeah, it is. It is a still dry cider.
Good. I'm glad that I'm remembering the correct one. So this I had a quite interesting experience of trying, where I was going to a friend's birthday party, and I had mentioned that, like, this friend who's not a cider nerd, but is an interested person, one of those people who gets very easily interested in things. And I basically said, well, I'll pick up a couple of bottles of fancy cider on the way, and you can try them. And I saw this Albee Hill in the London Cider Shack, the one in Borough Market.
It was London Cider House.
London Cider House, yep. So I went in there, saw they had an Albee Hill, was like, cool. I don't think I've ever seen Yves on a shelf in the UK, so I'm going to buy that on site. I don't think I'd had anything by then at this point. Anyway, I bring this to a house party and proceed to share it out into as many people as I can bear to share it with. And so a couple of reasons this was seminal. In terms of my relationship to it, it was just, I'd not really had all that much still cider at this point. I was, you know, still very much trying bottle conditioned and champagne method and all that kind of thing, largely having stuff that had a bit of fizz and having a great time. And then I tried this one and it just felt like there was almost no sense of process. It's almost entirely just fruit singing from the bottle or from the glass. Now, obviously there has been process. You can't get the fruit to sing like that unless you are making it very, very carefully. But this felt like such a full-throated and expressive, this is made of fruit. This is a drink that has been fermented from fruit, and just fantastic flavor, real elegance, like the dryness was offset. It wasn't sort of fearsomely dry, because I was a little bit worried, like, oh, but with stillness, there's nowhere to hide. Like, if it's still, I can't hide behind the bubbles or the flavors from the leaves and stuff like that. It's just going to be the thing, and might that be very intense if it's going to be dry? But the light and delicate fruitiness coming off that was just fantastic. And it was a real, really exciting, cool, here's another door that's just open for me. That it's not just, you know, it's not, okay, then now I like cider. I already liked cider at this point. But it's like, oh my God, there's so much more to discover. Mm. And also the fact that it's from the US. I think this was the second US cider I'd had. The first one was an ice cider from Eden. I always get Eden and Yves confused because it's E and then it's from the US.
Other letters.
Yeah, there's an E and other letters and it's from the US. Might as well be the same damn thing.
And they're also two incredibly, incredibly good cideries.
Are they both from both in Finger Lakes area?
No, Yves is Finger Lakes and
Oh, Eden's Vermont.
But I'm really glad that you mentioned Albee Hill, because I mean, you know, that would be a cider that was, I mean, you know, I'd be, if we were just doing a best ofs, you know, it would be right up there for seminal ciders for me. You know, I could easily have listed it, because I'm going and visiting Yves, and actually, you know, if you don't mind a bit of a flex, going up Albee Hill itself was just an incredible moment for me, and chatting to Autumn and Ezra about, like, their philosophies and, you know, their passion about expressing the place.
I love that article you wrote about it. That article you wrote about it was banging.
Oh, bless you. Well, it's, I mean, an incredibly inspirational place and cider. And so I'm very glad it was on your list, because I was feeling slightly guilty that it wasn't on mine, to be honest.
The second part of the why I felt it was seminal was because this was the first time that I was, like, pouring cider for people who, like, I wasn't just hanging out with one or two people. I was, like, at a party and people were coming in and being like, what's this? That looks interesting. And then pouring it, and the number of people whose, like, faces lit up. And I think there were, like, two or three separate people who did almost exactly the same, wait, cider can taste like this. I didn't know that this is what cider could taste like. This is totally different. I know that this will anger some people very greatly, but this is like wine and things like that. Where
that was the reaction that you were organically getting from people.
Exactly. And I wasn't angling for it either. I wasn't putting words in people's mouth or anything. It was genuine. Like it was really kind of related to the previous point where there's a little bit of a sense that I sometimes feel with where I'm like, you know, the fox whelp is for perverts and the very, very tannic things can sometimes be a little different or difficult the first time you try them. And there's a little bit of a sense of like, oh, I'm never going to get people to like the things that I like. I'm never going to have this. And then pouring this and people just being absolutely instantly 100%. Mm. This is great. I want to try this. I am interested now.
One of the most, I mean, you know, if I was making a list of, you know, ciders and perries where if there was somebody in the next room and I don't know what their tastes are and my life depends on them really, really loving whatever I put in front of them. Mm. You know, Eves is almost unequivocally good.
Yeah.
You know, the Albie Hill, it is just, yeah, a study in balance and elegance, whatever those two mean. You know, Albie Hill has them. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal drink by any
metric. Absolutely banging. Buy on site. Right, yeah. Your number three. I'm chivving you along because at some point this evening I need to cook dinner.
What a coward.
Yeah, I know, right.
So my number three is in my opinion, actually, another unequivocally good drink. And if my last one showed me what still dry cider could be, this is really the drink that cemented a love of and fascination in perry, but also showed me, you know what, the ceiling for this drink is higher than I realized. It is as high as the ceiling of you know, any other drink that I'm heavily into. And that's the Downside Special Reserve 2016. Made by Paul Ross in Somerset. And that perry was and remains just, you know, almost an anomalous point in its flavor. I have never tried another perry other than the 2017 Downside Special Reserve that had the same flavors as this perry. And I objectively know the four pairs that went into it. And they're an unusual mix because you've got Thorn and Winnell's Longdon, which are two of my absolute favourite perry pairs for sure. But you've also got two of my other favourites, which aren't British perry pairs. They're the Plante de Blanc, which is obviously the great pair of the Domfrontier region, and also Champagne Bratbirner, which is a German Swabian pair. That's probably most famously used in the Champagne Method perries of Jörg Geiger. But anyway, so Paul had used these four different pear varieties, and it was just, you know, on another level. It was one of those, Albert talked about, you know, when he's having a phenomenal meal, you know, it should put the knife and fork down and sit back and go, wow. You know, and that really rarely happens to me with drinks. I think I've been very, very privileged both in work and in the kind of freelance and hobbyist stuff that I've done with cider and whiskey and wine, that I've been really lucky to try some astonishing things. And to an extent that jades you, but I think more realistically it just means that whilst you're still keen to try every new thing and learn as much as you can and expand your world of flavor, the things that just come completely out of left field and taste completely different in a mind-bendingly brilliant way and that take you utterly by surprise and that you just don't have any context or explanation for becomes sort of fewer and fewer. And this was that. And interestingly, I had it quite early on in my cider and perry journey. I mean, long before I started writing in it, and I have James Finch to thank, our great friend, because he had, I think, written about it. And so I happened to find a couple of bottles at Middle Farm down in Sussex and buy them. And I had it, and, you know, it was phenomenal.
But sometimes, you know, you have these things you have at the start of your journey and you think, oh my God, that is just incredible. And you come back to them and you go, yeah, no, it's still decent, but, you know, my experience has broadened. But I loved this Perry so much that I wrote about it on Cider Review, and it was, you know, actually before it was Cider Review, when it was just my column on malt, and I still thought it was phenomenal. But I saved my very last bottle to drink when I had submitted the manuscript for Perry, A Drinker's Guide. And I was really terrified, you know, I was like, what if it's gone over the hill? What if it's not what I remember? What if it isn't? And I opened it, I think it was one of the last drinks I had before the end of last year. And I tasted it and I was just like, I am having the same experience now that I did 4 or 5 years ago. This is as high quality. It is as unique in its flavor, in its complexity and balance and quality. Nothing that I have tasted since in however many Perries that have led to the writing of a book about Perry has had the flavor profile that this Perry has. And it is still as good as I believed it was. And I still take as much joy in it. So that, yeah, that's my third seminal cider or Perry.
That's quite a one to follow up. Can you still get it? Or does it not?
No. It's a very sad story, which I will not go into on the podcast about the end of those bottles. But the good news is that Paul had moved on from Downside because he went to make cider and Perry for the Newt. He's now actually making his own stuff again under the Downside label. I don't know whether it's on sale yet. Oh. I only discovered this when I tasted it at Bath and West last year, so it may be if you visit Somerset, you can maybe get it. But I'm very much in hope that we will see Paul's stuff on shelves, and if people like Nikki and Cat in the Glass or whoever are listening, please hie thee to Somerset, buy Paul's stuff and stick it online so I can buy it and point people towards it.
So I can buy it all so nobody else can get it. Right then, so my fourth seminal cider is a bit of an off the wall one. Mine is a Halfpenny Green Charmat Method Ice Cider. So this one, I tried this at Ross Fest a year and a half ago. It was the 20, what year is it now? That'd be the 2022 Ross Fest, where Tony Lovering had his stand set up and was giving out samples. And I tried this and you know, we were talking about singularity, like the joy of something that is singular. And Tony Lovering and Halfpenny Green are a singular place to get cider from because, you know, can't remember exactly the way you phrased it, but it's something like that if there is some kind of consensus of this is generally how things are done, that he will just rip up the playbook and do something totally and wildly different. Mm. So the ice cider is one thing. The idea of then putting that through Charmat method, which is, to my understanding, Prosecco's made.
Was it? Yeah, which is traditional method. I mean, he does do Charmat, so it could be in either or both.
I remember distinctly that it was a Charmat method because I was like, "What the? Oh. What in God's name?" Because there was a traditional method, then there was a Charmat method, and I think I got the Charmat method because I was like, "This is who would take an ice cider and then do that to it? That is wild." But it was incredible, like a fizzy ice cider. It was batshit. But like, this is like his attitude to cider making, and what he's going to do is utterly joyous. Where, you know, there's a wonderful phrase about art, which is, you know, if it turns up in Alexander McKendrick's book about filmmaking. A lot of talking about film this episode, apologies to the listeners. But it's if you want
apologize,
to be
Justin.
If yeah, never apologize.
This
that's
is
not
the us episode. We can do what we want.
There's as a very brief aside, there's a concept called posters Bushido. Posting being obviously randomly posting crap online, and posters Bushido being the particular like honor code of what it takes to be a true poster. And one of the items, the honor code, is never apologize and never back down. I am emphatically not a person who lives his life according to posters by Bushido. But sorry, I've completely sidetracked myself. What was I saying?
And we must not edit this out. No, yeah. you were talking. You've sidetracked me. Gosh, maybe do edit this out.
Oh, God. So I was talking about the Charmat method. Charmat, that it's completely wacky. Fizzy ice cider. That's wild. Singular. Films. Yes, talking about film. Talking about that's film. It. We're back.
If you're gonna be
avant-garde, you've got to know what you're gonna be avant of. And once you know what you're avant of, you know, rock on and go crazy. And this really feels like that kind of summarizes that, where like some of the things, like, because it worked as well. It was delicious. It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It had all those amazing ice cider things. And then the fizz really brought something to it. It really kind of, you know, oddly enough, the intense kind of heavy, sometimes overwhelming, you know, when something is so sweet that it almost becomes bitter, that's a thing that ice cider can have. And that's wonderful. And it's why it's such a magnificent gastronomic drink. But having that little bit of like the fizz in there just lifted that sweetness. And suddenly something that I would think of more as like something to go with like a dessert or like as a finisher became like, well, this becomes quite a good, almost like aperitif, like a sherry or something, where it's got a little bit of brightness coming in amidst that kind of, you know, oaked paneled study or mead hall in winter vibe that ice cider can sometimes have. And I mean, I've got all the time in the world for Tony at Halfpenny Green because of his, you know, his incredibly non-conventional approach to cider making, and how he just makes things that are just great fun. That sense of excitement and experimentation of, well, what if I did this? Hmm. What if I did this? That I think is like he's a real jazz cider maker, and that's just on the list for something that has stuck in my mind as off the wall and cool and exciting and made by a singular cider maker.
Mm, he really, really is. Really, really is. And I remember last year, year before last now, but that was the first year when I kind of gathered a big group of friends for Ross Fest and, you know, dragged them all down. And the wonderful validating thing was that they all came back the year after as well. But that year, you know, they were all very new to cider, obviously you less so. But we were doing that thing of like gathering around in the barn, tasting all the new ciders that at the stands, and some incredible makers there. I mean, the likes of Bartistry and Artist Raw and Greg's Pit and all that sort of thing. But the one that all of my friends bought a cider from was Halfpenny Green. And, you know, I mean, phenomenal, phenomenal stuff.
I have just realized that I did misremember it was traditional method, not Charmat. I'm totally wrong.
I knew it.
Bollocks. Fuck. I fucked it. Because I remember standing there and he was talking about Charmat method and there were two bottles and I bought the traditional method because I was in a panic. God, I've shamed myself.
It was
I've
the triple myself. Whammy of Kieved ice cider traditional
that's
method.
That's right. It was Kieved as well. That's why I was thinking Charmat, because I was like, right, there was something beyond just traditional method that made it weird. Was it that it was Charmat? Because I did try Charmat. Well, excuse me, listeners, I misremembered. But yeah, Kieved traditional method ice cider.
Yeah, there's only one maker in the world who would have considered doing that
And then made something that was really good. Anyway, right, let's come on.
This has worked out very, very well, but yours leads very nicely into mine, which is another ice cider, which in its own way is as off the wall. Now, ice cider, we've talked about it on the podcast before, but it's one of those drinks that people just do not, you know, people who aren't into cider just do not associate with cider. You know, they taste it and they go, oh my God, what is that? And I remember my first exposure to it was having read about it in World's Best Cider, where Pete Brown calls it like drinking starlight. And you know, so obviously I read that and I was like, I must try some ice cider. I'm gonna go out and find it. And I tried some, and it is like drinking starlight. I mean, it's the most like intense, luscious,
rich, sticky, unctuous, beautiful drink that tends to just work magically, because as sweet as it is, it has that balancing acidity, so it never feels cloying or difficult. You have some sweet drinks where you're like, this is delicious, but I can't do more than a glass. I mean, ice cider, I've got to be careful. The bottle for not seeing the end of the day. But, so I am a huge, huge fan of ice cider. And some of the best in the world are made by Eden, who we've already mentioned. And that is where my fourth cider comes from. And it's Queen Mab, which is part of their Shakespeare series. And Queen Mab is as off the wall as Tony's is, because it's a single variety, Ashmead's Kernel, which has made some pretty tasty ciders. I like it as an apple. Coombe Maddock have used it in some tasty blends. It's been used by people like Bushell and Peck in Gloucestershire. But I don't think I would ever have had it as this is in my top 5 or even 10 varieties. But Eleanor, and the team at Eden tasted it and they went, wow, lots of acidity. This is going to need some time in oak. And they ended up giving it this ice cider they made. It was in barrel for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe longer.
Jesus.
And it was a 2011 or possibly the 2012 vintage. But either way, I tasted it and you've got this luscious, ice cider that has spent that long in oak, where all the time, with oak, you've got micro-oxidation, oxygen can get it. It totally transforms the profile. And you think, can something even survive that long in oak? And this one had not only survived, but it had come out at just a level of flavor and complexity and depth and intensity and vividness that I have not experienced in any other cider. And that I wrote when I tasted it that this is the best cider I've ever tried. I would still consider it the best cider I've ever tried. I mean, it is just the most mind-blowingly complex. If any wine fans listening amongst our 12 listeners, I've likened it to a Malik Pedro Jimenez, but it's actually closer probably to a really old Malik Madeira, because it's still got that acidity, it still has that vibrancy of fruit, but on top of that there's all these wonderful notes of maturation and oak and thyme. It's got tertiary notes, which is really rare on cider, because most of the time most ciders aren't built for aging, and B, most ciders aren't given that
could
time
you
break.
For the listeners who could you explain for the listeners who don't know about tertiary what tertiary
okay,
is?
Okay, so very, very quickly, primary notes are the flavors that we get just from the fresh fruit, so the notes that make foxhop taste of foxhop. Secondary notes are things that we have done to it in the cidery, be that put it in a barrel or age it on lees in the champagne method. Tertiary notes are the notes that come from maturation, so these can be dried fruit, raisiny, they can sometimes be gamey, rancio notes, and all of these sound a little bit odd, but you taste them. And when you've got something like Queen Mab that has so much fresh fruit character, but it's also got these secondary characteristics, these oak notes, and then these lovely, almost savory rancio notes, you've just got this mind-blowing complexity. And I immediately, one of the more expensive ciders I've ever bought, but as soon as I tasted it, I was like, I'm just gonna, I'll eat rice all month and buy a bunch of, as many more of these as I can, because this is just, something on another level. And I've still got 2 bottles left, and God knows when it's going to be special enough to open them. I think, using the sideways quote, the day you open an Eden Queen Mab, that is the special
occasion. So I guess the special occasion, Adam, is the next time I come to visit you and stay over in Reading.
No, I think only a fool opens that bottle with a view to sharing it. You tell people how good it is, they can buy their own if they'd like, but my bottles are mine.
I'm disowning you.
All right, what's your last seminal
Last one for me. So the last one for me was a real toss-up. So I'm going to mention them both, but only talk about one of them extensively. Both are Ross and Y ciders, because I couldn't help but shill for Ross.
This is the reason, famously, the real reason we can't have Albert on today, is that I suspected that we'd probably both be saying some pretty nice things about Ross. And I mean, for
we can't have that. We can't say that.
There's only a degree to which we can blow smoke. I know, it would be embarrassing. Embarrassing for him, really, which is why.
Really?
Chatting for an hour and a half. He's going to be raging. This is like the equivalent of like the message coming in from the parents who've gone off. You know, are you in bed yet? Yeah, we're not messing around. Anyway, sorry. Continue, Ross on Y.
It's okay. So the one I was thinking of was brown snout lightly conditioned, partially because that was one that I discovered that's one of my very favourite apples. But also because I have a very distinct sense memory of at a friend's birthday party in the woods with a fire and cooking meat over a fire in the evening in the woods in summer and drinking that felt like possibly my platonic ideal cider experience ever. But I realized that although the cider is amazing, that was simply a very lovely experience rather than one that really mattered for me in terms of my journey in cider. So the one that I've actually gone for is, last year, 2022, I, as you'll find out in the Toil episode that we definitely haven't recorded and then deleted because we didn't like what we recorded and are going to re-record it at some point, I spent a month, was it a month? Was it 2 weeks? Jeez, it was only 2 weeks. Fuck, it felt like a month. Yeah, I spent 2 weeks working at Ross on Y, and had a great time. You'll find out all about it in the episode. But this was an HMJ oak cask, Carrie Masters Jersey oak cask. Was it oak cask? I think some of it. Yeah, it was oak cask because I remember it was scrawled on the label. I think it had been topped up a number of times, so this might be a ship of Theseus. But it was in, I don't know what it's called, the big grey plastic things.
IBC.
No, it wasn't an IBC. So it was an IBC in the barn. And basically, when we had finished working for a day, everyone would go to the barn. And if you wanted to have a drink, you would get one from an IBC. And there were three there. I think one of them was some kind of Somerset Red Street blend. But I remember one of them was a Harry Masters Jersey oak cask. And this was... or it had an oak cask component in it. And this was interesting for me because this was at the point when I still wasn't really into HMJ and didn't really, I was like, I kind of appreciate it conceptually, but it's a bit much for me. And I'd been pressing HMJ at the same time. And this being late in the season, or the pressing season for HMJ, some of it was a bit squelchy, and sorting through that could get a bit grim because you'd be sorting and there was some that came in that were like, you know, quite a large amount of the harvest, you would be going, no, that's not good for making cider, that's rotten. And so, but nonetheless, I had been absolutely immersed in the smell of HMJ as an apple, not as a cider, as an apple. And a couple of things happened. So number one, I had the HMJ. After pressing it during the day, I had a cider made from the same type of apple and went, wait a minute. I had always thought that cider tasted of cider, but no, cider tastes and smells of the varietal. The varietal doesn't change magically into a completely different set of flavors and smells. This smells distinctively of itself, and started to enjoy it for what it was. Started to be like, okay, this is, I can now get a sense of this smell. It seems silly to say it, but this smells of itself. And the other thing was just having a cider that had been made on the site from the apples that grew on the site at the end of a day working on the site was just quite powerful. And having it like coming out of an IBC, not from a 750 poured from a bottle, but just having it and being like, right, I shove a glass underneath, I turn it on, I take it away. It's as simple as that. There was a real directness to that, and just a quite powerful sense of this is a thing that has been made here by the people that I am sat amongst. I was privileged to spend even 2 weeks working amongst these people, but the people there were the people who worked there the whole time. Like, I was very much, you know, 2 weeks is nothing. It's a tiny fraction of the actual period of pressing and harvesting. I was doing a tiny amount of what these people do daily. But being around the people who made it and in the place where it was grown and made, and having an apple that I initially was a little bit leery of, and then coming to love it by the experience of pressing it and then drinking it in the evening, that was incredible. That was a really incredible experience.
That's awesome. And such a good way to round off. I mean, you know, having started your list today with, like, you know, going out, didn't know anything, didn't know what to expect, to like sitting in the barn, having just pressed the fruit.
Yeah.
And you're tasting a cider made from that same variety, you know, in like the heart of Three Counties Cider. Now that is the journey. Well, mine is also a Ross and Wye. And I mean, where do you even start? Like, yeah, it's a good job that Arbor isn't sitting in on this one, because I cannot overstate how seminal Ross on Wye as a whole has been to my experience of cider. I mean, you know, we've talked about how accessible aspirational cider is, but almost no one, I would say only Little Pomona kind of really in my experience has kind of given me the same level of access that Albert has. And right from the very start, I mean, before I wrote about it, you know, when I was just somebody from Twitter, it was come in, try everything, let us share our enthusiasm, we're delighted that you have questions. And so many seminal ciders over the years. I mean, you know, do I list the Fox Whelp that I served at my wedding? I mean, I'll probably get in trouble for not listing the Little Pomona Dabinet that Caroline and I made as one of my seminal ciders. But, you know, it was fine. It was a cast Dabinet. It's delicious. It's drinking really well now. I've got any, but it's not one of my five. You know,
that's one of the five best. That's not one of the five seminal, if that makes sense.
You know, it's like, do I go for C31, which is like a 2015 or 2016 Yarlington mill that I know would be one of the ciders if Durham's station house, Chris and Susanna, were on, you know, and that was something that like cemented Yarlington as a favorite variety of mine and showed me what single varieties could be. You know, or raison d'etre is probably the aspirational side that I've gone on to drink more of than any other, and that I absolutely love. And I've gone on a journey with that from like not really knowing how to serve it to it just being my don't know what I want, I'm gonna have the raison d'etre. But no, the seminal Ross on Wye for me is the Flaky Bark 2017 batch 2. And everything that I have come to love about Perry and like the drink generally is wrapped up in this one bottle. I mean, I love the story of Flaky Bark. I love that it was thought extinct and then Charles Martel discovers it just going up a hill in a horse and cart, and there's just these last six trees clinging to the hill. I love that it has captured the mind of like Perry lovers worldwide. I mean, obviously Barry, a Kirtle writer, has now grafted it in Germany. In his international Perry Pear project. I've spoken to really lovely guy and great cider and Perry maker, Dave Carr, Raging Cider and Mead in California. And he was inspired by Flaky Bark, you know. And I love that it is so belligerently other. I mean, it refutes all the generalizations of Perry. You know, people say it's sweet and light and ethereal. No, Flaky Bark is hulking and muscular, and it tastes of earth and game and fermentation. And it's not a Perry that everyone's just going to go, yes, I love this. This is so easy drinking and light and delicate. No, it insists upon itself. And it is just the most marvelous, intense and distinct and idiosyncratic Perry. And I love its flavors. You know, there is no other Perry that tastes like Flaky Bark. But the fact that it exists and that, you know, there are people like Mike and Albert who understand how precious it is and that it needs to survive, and that these six trees are this vital strand in the tapestry of our biodiversity, but also in our history of rural drinks and the history of cider and perry. You know, it has been kept alive just because the team at Ross & Wye understand that it is important, but also because it makes this glorious, unique and uniquely characterful drink. And I love it. And it has that thing that you were talking about earlier, where it just evokes tree and earth and pear skin. And I always want to drink flaky bark outside, because there are very few drinks that actually smell of the outdoors in the best sense possible. Almost no wine smells of actual outdoors, but flaky bark really viscerally does. And you know, it's one of the drinks that made me want to write more about perry and think, you know, here is a drink that deserves to be so much more known than it is, that is unique, that would be a tragedy if it were lost.
And I mean, just to sort of jump in and continue that thought, like the sense of it smelling of the outdoors, it doesn't just smell of the outdoors, it smells of season. It smells of autumn and winter to me, very powerfully. Like that's the sense that it creates in me. And obviously drink it when you like. It's delicious in summer, it's great in spring, it's a great drink. But in terms of the it's a drink that invites romanticization very, very easily, just by its story, by its flavor profile. It's a very easy drink to become imaginative and expressive about, which I think is a really good sign of anything. You know, if it invites you along flights of fancy, and it invites you along, like, Mahan, I would love to pen, you know, paragraphs about this, then I think that's. Like that, there's not many other things at all that really inspire in the same way.
No.
It always makes me think of, like, it's funny that we talk a lot about how in the UK at least cider and perry are in the public consciousness almost inextricably linked with summer. And my experience of bittersweets, but especially with flaky bark, is that I can't think of a better fit for it than autumn and winter.
Mm.
That's a
slightly liminal period.
It's a drink for dark nights.
To
wax lyrical for a moment, there's a bit in, I can't remember the exact quote, and we're simply going to reference the general sense of it, but in Hogfather, Terry Pratchett's book, there's a bit when basically you go back to the origin in the Discworld of the Santa Claus analog. And it's talking about this kind of terrifying pig god that's snuffling around in darkness. And it's very primal. But I feel like that's something that flaky bark does for me, is that there's a sense of, that sort of earth and fermentation and yet is also tasty and sweet and lovely.
I think that's it. It's, you know, I can't really think of a more evocative drink. And I can see the direct line from all the flaky barks that I've had of Albert's, but particularly from batch 2 of 2017, which is the pure, you know, full throttle, you know, flaky bark. I can see the direct line from that drink to, you know, to the fact that Perry, a drinker's guide, is going to exist. And so that is absolutely, you know, that was first on my list when we were going to come up with these ciders and perries. But yeah, so there we go. Those are 10 pretty good ciders and perries, I think. Yeah,
an episode of nearly 2 hours. It's all right. We'll cut down some of it.
Yeah,
a bonus episode.
No. This is uncut, unfiltered, all that sort of stuff, just as we demand our cider and perry to be. I would like to lengthen this ever so slightly. Having mentioned the book, I'm going to shamelessly plug it again, because
no,
it is
plug away, I was going to say.
Pre-order. because I don't think it has been available to pre-order. So if you would like to learn about things like Flaky Bart and Aurora and Downside, you can do so via Perrier Drinker's Guide. And it's now available to pre-order on Camera's website. If you Google Perrier Drinker's Guide, it should be one of the first links that pops up. So I'd be super, super grateful, and I would hope that you enjoy it. It's going to be coming along pretty soon, less than 2 months now.
Well, I will plug that too.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for sharing your seminal ciders with me. I think this was exactly kind of what I wanted to get out of this, these kind of deep and meaningful conversations. And if we have overrun slightly the 25 minutes we said that this episode was going to be, I think Albert
by a mere 300%.
But I think that Albert will agree that it has been in the best of causes, which is sharing the joy and the deep personal moments that wonderful ciders and Perries can give us, and the fact that we've blown a fair bit of smoke at the end there won't hurt us either. Justin, thank you so much. Thank you to all of our 12 listeners, wherever you are. And we'll see you or talk to you next time.
See you next time. Bye-bye.